From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our film series with one that premiered at Sundance this year. It's part documentary, part scripted feature. The feature part is kind of like a heist film, only in reverse. It's the story of a group of dreamers, young, undocumented immigrants, who hatch a plan to break into, not out of, an immigration detention center. The film is called The Infiltrators. We'll be right back.
I'm Andrew Becker, the news director here at KUER. Our newsroom is growing, with new reporters set to join us in the coming months. In the meantime, we want to know, what issues should we be covering where you live? What stories should we be telling in your community? Help us improve our coverage of Utah by answering a few short questions. Go to KUER.org and click Community Feedback Form under the About tab.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Christine Ibarra and Alex Rivera say they've made a documentary about immigration that doesn't portray immigrants in the way they're usually shown, as victims. The protagonists in their film are dreamers, young, undocumented immigrants, and they're not remotely passive. In fact, they've seized the initiative. They're smart and sophisticated, and they've come up with a novel plan to expose the abuses of the immigration system. And here's the plan. They get themselves arrested and detained by Border Patrol agents. The idea is to get inside a detention center. And once there, they can not only work with isolated detainees to make them aware of their rights and get them released, but make a powerful political statement at the same time. The film is called The Infiltrators. It premiered at Sundance this year. This is part of our documentary series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening the film next week, and we'll give you details about that a little bit later. Today, Christine Ibarra and Alex Rivera are joining us to talk about the film. They wrote and directed the film, and they joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Would you just both take a minute, if you would, and talk a little bit about your work on immigration issues before the film, maybe? Because you've both been doing this for quite some time, and I just wanted to get a sense of the way, what got you into just thinking about these issues. I mean, I guess it's obvious, the personal connections, but say a little bit about that, if you wouldn't mind, at first.
Both Alex and I come from families of border crossers, and we've been border crossers for generations. We go back and forth. It's just, you know, it's just what we do. And in choosing the types of stories that I want to tell personally, border crossing influences the way that I tell stories, because it's not just the content that I choose that's about border crossing, but it's also the style. I think about the visual language, and I wonder how I can cross the bridge between my family's and my friends' visual style and my American upbringing.
Yeah.
And so I'm constantly looking for content that is bring a new view of borderland culture or a new story about what the border is.
One of the things you've said, you've talked about, is how part of what draws you into filmmaking is this desire to, and this is how you put it, translate American culture to my immigrant parents. Explain that. I thought that was really interesting.
So, yeah, so there's this way of seeing when you grow up along the border, when you grow up in a different country.
Yeah.
So you have this history, this way of seeing that sometimes creates a tension with the way that, you know, the new generation sees the world. So there's this kind of this culture clash, right, between, you know, the immigrant generation and the first generation. And it comes through in storytelling style sometimes. You know, it's like in my past work, you know, I've been interested in the telenovela, for example.
Yeah.
I've been, I've been interested in different types of drama that's maybe like, you know, melodrama. And I'm interested in mixing Spanish and English.
Yeah.
So I look at that when I think about storytelling choices, and I look at how we can tilt the lens into find a new entry point into discussing borderland issues.
Alex, do you think in similar ways, translating this visual language in these two different worlds?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, my kind of interest has been in, as a kid of an immigrant father, a father from Peru, but also someone who grew up here in the U.S., very immersed in Star Wars and like American pop culture. I've always been curious, through my adult life, to try to figure out, is there a way to tell stories that would resonate and say something true about the experience of folks like my border transgressing Peruvian family that would also speak in a pop culture language that could speak to an audience that doesn't care about those issues, an audience that's coming into the cinema to eat popcorn and have fun. But then, so was there a way to kind of build a cinema that was like entertaining, pop, fun, seductive, but also grounded in these political realities that really we don't see represented very much in the pop cultural space. And so that's taken a bunch of different shapes through the past 20 years of my career, that kind of exploration of how can we speak about border crossing, immigration, the Latino experience in this country, but in a language that's sort of pop and fun and surprising.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. There's this theme, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but it's like these dreamers are many of them, most of them, I think, are thoroughly American. And then on this other hand, they're being thought of in this country in these different ways. There's this moment when Vidriana is trying to get herself detained and she gets sort of frustrated because she's unable to, because she's not perceived as, not Latina enough. Like, she's so American and it really bothers her. And so living in those two worlds almost seems like a theme in this story.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the things that drew us in, was just the unique world of these characters and how they kind of embody in some ways the contradictions of our immigration debate in this country. And what I mean by that is that there is this kind of sort of sympathetic discourse around the dreamers. They speak English, they're very Americanized, look at them, they're good kids. And then this other discourse that is pretty broad about, the border crossers are criminals, they're illegals, they're aliens, they're invaders. Well, the truth is that's one family you're speaking about. You know, the dreamers' parents carried them through the deserts. They are one family, and that's important. It's important, I think, to fuse those together and to say, look, these are all just families trying to make it through the world. You know, and that's what's going on here. And this story of the infiltrators, about dreamers that go into detention to help get other immigrants out, kind of was exciting to us on one level because it fused those together. And it was, you enter through the dreamer, but you end up in a detention center with, you know, immigrants who are patently being seen as disposable by our country's political system.
I know you both must have kind of particular stories that drew you into this. Christina, you've talked about this story I wanted to ask you about, where you once saw this testimonial of a young undocumented woman. And there was this, I think this is how you described it, this sense of fearlessness that seems to have really had a powerful effect on you. And I just wanted you to talk about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so before the protesters go and do their action, many times they'll create a testimonial in case they do get arrested by performing this act of civil disobedience and maybe get sent to a detention center and perhaps deported. I mean, they know this is a risk that they're taking by performing this act of civil disobedience, and so they have a final video that they create, a homemade video for their family. And it explains why they're doing it, how upset they are, and that they hope that they see their family again. This woman, she really impressed me because she was this young woman. And like you said, there's this sense of belonging that people carry here growing up here, whether they're documented or not.
Yeah.
And she just seemed to have this tension with that sense. And I remember thinking about my father. My father, he was undocumented when he was around 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering about him and whether if he had met her at that age, how his life might be different, because she just had this bravery around her where there was this risk that she was taking. She was fully aware of it, and it was strategic. It was a very sophisticated political decision that she was making. And it just made me think about if she doesn't belong here in the United States, then who does?
Yeah.
You know, she's, you know, embodying all the values that we have as Americans.
Alex, when did you first start noticing this kind of new phenomenon? I think you've talked about it like it was around 2010, where you start to see undocumented people becoming activists. I mean, using this kind of fearlessness. When did you first start noticing it?
Yeah, so I've been making films and videos about immigration since the mid-1990s. And, you know, the issue has sort of been there rumbling all along. And sometimes it goes up in the public imagination and the public focus, and sometimes it goes down. But over that time period, there were certain things I'd never seen. And one that I'd never seen was undocumented folks walking out into public, declaring their status, sitting down in the middle of a street saying, arrest me, take me away, I'm done. I want to either be here, or if you're going to send me away, then send me away. But we're done hiding. And that moment happened in 2010. And it really is a moment, in my opinion, in world history. There are undocumented folks around the whole planet. The first wave of undocumented civil disobedience was here in this country, in Arizona, in 2010, a group of four undocumented youth sat in Senator McCain's office and demanded that he support the DREAM Act. And they were ultimately arrested. They faced their deportation, but they were released. And so when they were released, they did it again and again and again. And about the fifth time they did it, I reached out to a friend who knew the organizers. And I said, I think there's a film here. I want to meet these folks and understand what's in their heads. What are they going through? Mm. And so that was where this project, The Infiltrators, began, was just a curiosity. I thought I'd make a short film. But the problem was every time I started to edit, they went and did something bigger and more interesting.
Yeah.
And so I had to just sort of stop editing. Christina started to work with me, and we started to just follow this group that was known as the National Immigrant Youth Alliance. And it was really a long journey, and a journey for me, at least, of a lot of learning, just reckoning with this, a different way of seeing the world. Even though I come from an immigrant family, I'm not an undocumented person myself. I didn't grow up that way. And so engaging with this group that was led by undocumented youth, that was taking these life or death risks. One of the leaders of the group is a young gay man from Iran. Mm-hmm. So if he gets deported to Iran, he's in a very grave situation. And so the stakes couldn't be higher. But the group was fascinating because it was also full of laughter and creativity and just the life. There's no other way to put it, but it was just full of life. And so it was like a real kind of wonderful journey through this like incredibly searing political time.
Yeah. That's Alex Rivera. Along with Christina Ibarra, they wrote and directed the documentary film The Infiltrators. Next Wednesday night, that's April 17th, we're going to be screening the film as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. It's at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. Alex Rivera will be there for a Q&A after the film. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our film series with one that premiered at Sundance this year. It's part documentary, part scripted feature. The feature part is kind of like a heist film, only in reverse. This is the story of a group of dreamers, young, undocumented immigrants who have this plan to break into, not out of, into an immigration detention center. The film is called The Infiltrators. We're going to be screening it next week. We're talking about it today with the filmmakers Alex Rivera and Christina Ibarra. What is it like if you are living in the United States as an undocumented, as a dreamer? Or, I mean, because one of the things, you know, we've been talking about is a lot of them have been here for years and years. And this is how you begin the film, with this idea that people grew up knowing they could be taken by the government. So is it just that there is this, that constant tension, as you mentioned, that they're tired of, they want this thing resolved. I mean, what's it like? Because it seems like that's what you're getting at here.
Yeah. So I think there's, in terms of, what does it mean to be undocumented? I mean, just starting with that word, I find it gummy. It's not a very passion-filled word. It's like a technical word. And starting there, there's a series of like challenges in terms of understanding what this experience is like. But, you know, all I can say is that if any of us tries to remember our high school years, how traumatic that is, just going through high school, it's like a horrible experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then if you add into that, okay, all of your friends are getting driver's license and you discover you can't. And then you discover all your friends are going to college and then you can't. And your friends are getting a job and then you can't. And then add on to that, when you start to become an aware adult, the knowledge that this sort of disciplinary system, the police, think about how scary it is when any of us gets pulled over by a cop. Well, what if that was coupled with this feeling like that cop could take away your mom or your dad and you might never see them again? So it's, you know, in listening to undocumented folks create these testimonial videos, listening to them speak in interviews, etc., there's this kind of like sedimentary layer of experiences, some of them very small. I can't get into an R-rated movie because I don't have an ID. Mm. And some of them incredibly big. What happens when I wake up and my parents aren't there anymore? They don't come home from work. That swirl of things was kind of the pressure cooker that led to this political movement in 2010, which was focused and started around the DREAM Act, a piece of legislation to give a pathway to citizenship to the young immigrants. But that at that time in 2010, 2011, 2012 kind of spiraled out of control.
Yeah.
And that movement went on to push for much bigger things and really to attack the kind of integrity of the immigration enforcement system as a whole.
Let's point out, as you do in the film, that these deportations happen all the time. I think it's like more than 1,000 a day. And we should point out, as has been noted, you know, President Obama, when he was president, deportations hit this all-time high, even as the number of, you know, people crossing the border is going down. There's a massive operation going on, and it gets you to sort of the setting for the film. It's this kind of purgatory. So help us set this up, because it's an important part of the plot. You explain that most immigrants pass through this purgatory on their way out of the country if they've been detained, and it's this detention center, and there are a lot of them. So maybe you guys set this part up, this setting for the film.
Yeah, so the film takes place largely inside of an immigrant detention center. And, well, what is a detention center? Well, first of all, there's about 200 of them across the country. And a detention center is a place where people are held, they're detained, but it's important to even think about, why is it called that? Why isn't it called a jail or a prison? Mm. Well, it's not called a jail or a prison because immigration in this country is actually, it's not a crime. It's not a crime to be in this country without papers. If it was a crime, then it would be police that would apprehend immigrants. Immigrants would get their Miranda rights read to them. They would have a trial. They'd be viewed innocent until proven guilty. None of that applies to immigrants. Immigrants are subject to a separate body of law, immigration law. And it's essentially what's known as like an administrative or a civil offense. And so it's a long story. We could talk about it if you want, going back about 120 years in terms of the court rulings that have given birth to this weird parallel enforcement system. But essentially, when an immigrant makes contact with an immigration official, that official can decide right there on the spot, I'm going to hold you or not. Mm-hmm. You don't get a trial. You don't get a sentence. If they decide to hold you, you're put in this place called the detention center. Yeah. It sure looks like a jail, but we don't call it a jail.
Right.
And because you're not being punished, you don't get a lawyer. And because you're not being punished because you haven't committed a crime, you don't get a sentence. We're just going to hold you. How long are we going to hold you? Well, it might be a day. It might be a year. There are cases of it being 5 years. And so these detention centers are bizarre, upside-down spaces in our criminal justice system that are not in the criminal justice system. They're this sort of weird shadow system. And basically why people are being held there is until there can be a ruling made on their immigration status. And so they'll either be released or they'll be deported. What triggers those things? Well, it's again, it can be an immigration judge that could decide your fate. Alternately, an ICE official can just say, you know what, we're going to let you out, go home, come back in a year. And so it's this bizarre Kafkaesque upside down land in which real lives are at stake. Families are obviously we know now families are in there together. Sometimes families are torn apart. The stakes couldn't be any higher. And the sort of strangeness of the system couldn't be any more extreme. It's a very challenging place to understand. And that was, as filmmakers, one of our challenges was how do we set a story inside this landscape? You have to first kind of unpack it. And so we tried to use a bunch of techniques as filmmakers to make this system clear and understandable to an audience enough that they could understand and enjoy the journey inside it.
Well, let's say a little bit more about that. So you had this problem you had to solve. I mean, how do you follow characters if you're making a documentary once they end up inside a place? So you dramatize what's going on inside. Was this an obvious way of doing it at first, that create a dramatized part of the film and then juxtapose that against the real stuff that's going on outside?
You know, so when you mentioned Viridiana preparing to go inside,
yeah,
that moment for us as filmmakers was really pivotal in deciding how to tell this story. Because once we decided that we were doing this one story inside this one immigration center, it was one infiltration that we were focusing on, and it had a beginning, middle, and end, then there's this question is like, how do you see what is invisible? Like, once the protagonists are successfully detained, we lose them from the camera lens. So then how do we keep telling the story? And we're inspired by the creativity of the activists we're following. Hmm. So they have been doing deportation defense work for many, many years. They've been learning all these stories. And this was a moment where Viridiana was embodying this one story that she knew very, very well from all of her deportation work. And so she became a performer. And in seeing her transform herself into this role that she was playing, it really allowed us this creative opportunity to think about actors and how actors might be able to dramatize what we're not seeing inside. And so the question then became, how do you marry the two worlds so that you have this seamless emotional narrative flow between inside and outside? And so that's where we, you know, had to come up with these ways of making it very clear that we were now in a dramatized space, but they were the same people.
It gives us a chance to play a moment from the film. It was one of my favorite moments, I have to say, and it's this role-playing scene. It's great because Viridiana is playing this role to try to get herself detained, because she's tried it once and it didn't work because she And we can talk about that in a minute if we want to, because I think her reaction to not being able to get in, not being able to be detained that first time because maybe she's overly dressed and she wore makeup, she didn't fit a stereotype that the border crossing patrol people were interested in. And so she dresses in a stereotypical way, and she's trying to create this role, as you mentioned. And there's this moment that's fascinating where we'll hear in this moment, Mohammed, whom you mentioned earlier, is helping her sort of play this role.
Mister, I'm here to turn myself in.
No, too formal. Too dreamer.
I'm here.
It's gotta be Spanish.
I hear to turn self in.
I can almost compare it to a theater play. Mo being the director, Aunt Marco and I being actors.
Yo no tengo a nadie aquí, señor. Yo ya tengo mi familia. Me quiero regresar a México. Quiero ir a estar allá con mi familia. Mi esposo fue deportado. Yo ya no tengo nada que hacer aquí.
You're very good when you're whining as well. Like when you made it sound very whiny. No, no, but like very whiny in terms of like, because then more of your sadness came out in it. And that's really good because it's natural desperation. So make it sound desperate.
Talk a little bit about this particular moment, because I think it reveals who this group of activists really is.
So this is a moment when they're preparing to try to get Viri detained. And, you know, and they went once already to a Border Patrol station. She knocked on the door and tried to get detained once, and she was turned away. Mm-hmm. They were wondering why. And because, you know, her birthday was approaching. She was wearing a fabulous dress. Mm-hmm. And she is here in this country, well, people might say illegally, but she's undocumented. So by one logic, it's like knock on the door, they should take me away, right? Well, they didn't. Why not? And so their analysis is that the reason she failed the first time is because she looked too upper class, basically, mm-hmm. too dreamer.
Yeah.
And so here she's trying to get into a different mode, a different performance. And so she's dressed down, trying to dress more like a day laborer, like perhaps someone who cleans houses. And she's using her Spanish, which she inherited from her family. She speaks perfect Spanish as well as perfect English. So she's planning to go up now speaking Spanish. And so there's this role play, which is very fun and funny. And then it's also, to me anyways, really profound because yeah. it has to do with the way that this immigration system that exists around us, we all have a sense for this. It runs on profiling. It runs on stereotype. When immigration decides who they can walk up to and say, show me your papers,
yep.
they're making that decision based on skin color. They're making it based on appearance. So they're basically subverting the system. They're owning these stereotypes and trying to flip them around. And instead of those stereotypes being something that punish them or punish their families, saying this time we're going to lay a trap and we're going to get taken in on purpose because we have a mission. We want to go in and we want to get something done. We want to help other people get out. And so we're going to use this fact that you see me in a certain way. We're going to use it to our advantage this time.
Talk a little bit more about the filmmaking challenges. I mean, I think you've both mentioned how in some ways you had to, I think this is how you've explained it, build the storytelling elements in reverse. You have to sort of get the documentary part in line, and then you have to write a script based on that part. Is that how it worked?
So the basic process was we had to edit the documentary material to lay out the story, and then because the story was taking us into a detention center, there was all these parts of it that we had no footage for. And so we had to decide what were we going to do to see inside the detention center, to visualize that world. And we considered animation. We considered like very abstract kind of recreations. But we ultimately settled on let's make it like a movie, almost like the Ocean's 11 of immigration.
Right.
And, you know, and so, yeah, and because it has that element, it's breaking into jail to break people out. It is a heist. And the focus of the heist is this one immigrant that whose family had reached out to the activists. And so they're going in to rescue this man. It's got a certain like almost A-team type of quality to
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
But so we decided for the recreations to try to film them like a movie, a controlled camera, a fine cinematic lens, mm-hmm. controlled light, and that would guide the audience also. And so they didn't get confused about what was documentary and what was recreation. We wanted to do this film, which is complicated formally. It's blending together documentary and scripted material. However, we wanted the audience to know exactly where they were so that they could focus on just a great story.
Yeah.
And so that was how he sort of organized the visual approach.
Here's another moment from the film, because I want to give listeners a chance to hear how the scripted elements work. So you're following Marco, who is in Broward, that detention center we were talking about. He's working the place inside now, talking to those he thinks he can help. And he approaches, at this particular moment, a young immigrant who's been detained and is going to be deported. His name is Ismael. Here's another moment from the film.
Hey, I'm working with a group, and we're trying to get people out of here. Just wondering if I can give you their number.
Get people out?
How? Well, how'd you end up in here?
So stupid, man. I don't have a driver's license. So I was riding my bike on the sidewalk, and I get stopped by the cops. They hand me over to ICE.
Damn. But the flip side is this. As quick as they sweep you up, they can release you. All it takes is someone from ICE, from the president on down, to make that call. That's what our group does. We put pressure on those people. It's your book. Call this number. Tell them Marco told you to call.
Okay. So how does it work? The idea is to put pressure on people. I mean, as Marco Saavedra says early in the film, everyone needs a plan. And this is a new plan. This is a new idea. Talk a little bit about how this works, because this plan is novel and it's kind of risky. How does it work?
Sure. So, again, in a jail, there's a certain process when you're in a jail. You've been locked up. There's in theory, been a trial. You've got a sentence, etc. In immigration, there's none of that. People are held administratively, and so they can be swept up one day, and then again, they can be held for very long periods of time, short periods of time, and then they can be kind of hiccuped out randomly. Mm. Well, why do people just get kind of hiccuped out? We were in El Paso just a few months ago seeing hundreds of people getting dropped off at the bus station. Because why? Because the detention center was full. So they decided to let them out and say, come back in a year, check in with us. Right. And so this system of immigration detention is in a way soft around the edges. People can be swallowed up and released almost randomly. And so what that means is it's also vulnerable to pressure. And so that's what these activists are there to do. They're in detention so they can talk to people, learn about who they are and what levers of power they have accessible to them. Are they members of a church? Are they in a union? Are they do they have an asylum claim that maybe they're not even aware of? Is there a politician who cares about Venezuela because they're against the Chavez regime? And so maybe this person from Venezuela would be sympathetic to that politician who could then call ICE and get that person released. So every immigrant needs a kind of custom campaign around them, but every immigrant can get out of detention. And so the activists are in detention to learn those stories and to build those campaigns and create little bits of political pressure to get people out. Mm. And so that's the idea. It's both complicated and simple. It's get in to get people out.
Right. Well, let me play another moment from the film, because this is Mohammed Abdullahi talking. He's talking about the circumstances at the heart of that film, this idea that, as you mentioned, when you go public with your activism, it gives you a kind of cover.
The one thing that every undocumented kid is told is, you know, if you see a police officer, run and hide because you could get turned over to immigration. What we learned is that to actually have power as an immigrant, you have to do the exact opposite.
Whenever we got arrested publicly, ICE was nowhere to be found.
Let's go. Let's go.
So once we sort of had the safety of knowing that we could not be deported, we sort of had infinite possibilities.
But that seems risky. Is it a safe assumption that they won't be deported? I mean, what are the risks involved in something like this?
Yeah, so this this moment of discovery for these young undocumented activists that they could go and do a sit-in and create political noise and not be sent away, not be banished, not be deported. That moment of that aha moment happened in 2010, and these were the Obama years.
Yeah.
And the Obama years in terms of immigration are kind of seared by this contradiction. On one side, Obama oversaw absolutely record deportations, more than any president in U.S. history. On the other hand, he was out in public saying really nice things about immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so that created this little space of opportunity where activists, dreamers primarily, were able to go out into the public sphere and say, you know what, I'm going to get arrested not at night riding my bike or not, you know, at a random checkpoint. I'm not going to get arrested at my job. I'm going to get arrested in your office. Then what happens? I'm going to get arrested in front of news cameras. Then what happens? And what happened was the system balked, let them out. And so then this group, the National Immigrant Youth Alliance, that pioneered this strategy said, okay, well, if that's the game, if we're safe, if we're in public, then let's get a lot of people to do it, and let's get a lot of people in public. And so then they organized this series of actions across the country, not in San Francisco and New York, but we're talking about in Alabama, in Florida, in Georgia, in Arizona, in places where immigrants were most under attack. They went there and did these kind of public actions with a calculus that if they could make noise, they could be safe.
Right. So how does it work today, though? It made me wonder, would this sort of same sort of strategy work with it may have worked in the Obama administration. Would it work? Does it work in the Trump administration?
Yeah, so there's a big question mark about that right now. There are still undocumented youth dreamers doing civil disobedience now, but there's also this change in terms of DACA, you know, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which is a sort of liminal temporary protection for dreamers and that a lot of the activists have now. And so that they have a little legal leg to stand on that they didn't have back then. So the landscape has shifted in that sense. And then it's also shifted in the sense that right now it's not fully clear that if you make noise and get on the news that protects you right now, because the administration is not really out there saying lots of sympathetic things about immigrants. And so the kind of contradiction of the Obama era has kind of inverted in a way, because another reality is deportations currently are down.
Yeah.
You know, Trump is actually deporting substantially fewer immigrants than Obama did. However, his rhetoric is a lot more harsh. And so it's like, so the political space is kind of very topsy-turvy right now. And we're unfortunately right in its crosshairs, because one of our protagonists of our film, a man named Claudio Rojas, who was the sort of main immigrant that the infiltrators went to rescue, he was just detained again. He's been free for the past 7 years, and he's currently today, as we're recording this, sitting in the Chrome Detention Center in South Florida. And so the activists are working again. We're working at their side, building a campaign to try to get Claudio out again. And so in a sense, we're kind of living inside the story of the film, or we're living inside the sequel. It's the same campaign. It's Free Claudio. That was the sort of core of the story of the film. And now we're living through it again with the film as part of the story.
Say something more about Claudio, just who he is. There's a particular moment where they're trying to come up with a strategy to get attention, and the idea comes up, let's do a group fast or a hunger strike. The way they conceive of it is more of a fast, although I guess it's kind of the same thing. And Claudio is this sort of father figure, at least he comes across that way in the film, in Broward. They look up to him, and he's so seems like so charismatic, and he gives this speech where he says, look, it's like in the Bible when Joshua walks around the walls of Jericho and they use their, you know, their faith and their perseverance to get the walls come tumbling down. It's kind of a lovely moment, and I just wanted to have you say a little bit more about Claudio and where he fits in the story.
So Claudio is the original mission of the infiltrators when they go inside. There's a young man who reaches out to them, to the infiltrators, Emiliano Rojas. And Emiliano is the first son out of two from Claudio Rojas's family. And Claudio, he's a very spiritual man. He's somebody who is always trying to do the right thing. He believes in community. And when he's trapped inside of this detention center, Marco goes inside to try to get him out. Like you mentioned, Marco and Claudio begin to have almost like a father and son relationship, where Claudio begins to show Marco how the institution works, how you might be able to organize without being seen, how to stay away from trouble. And together they start to impact each other. And Claudio, already a natural organizer, really understands the power of organizing inside, and decides that he's going to focus on his spirituality, which is what has been carrying him through these days inside detention. He's a very disciplined person, and just tries to convince a diverse group of detainees, from basically the leaders of these different groups, tries to convince them to join him in this fast. That he's very careful to call a fast, because he understands that if he calls it a hunger strike, then it will be seen as a protest. Mm-hmm. Whereas mm-hmm. if you're doing this through your spiritual motivations, then it really is more of a personal religious choice. And so that's what keeps him safe for a time.
And Claudio is from Argentina. He's been living in Florida. At the time of the infiltration, he'd been there for 12 years. As of today, he's been there for 20 years. He's got two sons, a wife, now a citizen grandson here in Florida. He's a gardener. That's his work. He's a Pentecostal churchgoer. He's never committed a crime. So he's sort of like, within the world of undocumented folks, he's sort of like, you know, he's almost like your model undocumented person. He's really just, there's sort of not a lot of complicating legal factors. He came as a tourist. His church offered to give him a job at maintaining the grounds. He wanted that job. They tried to sponsor him. The sponsorship failed. So he's been here like for 20 years, building a family and a life. He's a person who has now been locked up in detention three times. And just to think about, like, who's the victim? Why are we spending, you know, $180 a night locking him up? It's a, it's just a bizarre situation. But in any case, Claudio is a spiritual man, and ultimately, in the story of the film and in the real story, when the campaign seemed to be stalling and when there was sort of no hope, he did turn to his faith and fasted. And in reality, he fasted for 30 days in this detention center. Wow. And ultimately, hundreds of other people joined him. And this is all, it's documented in government documents we received through a Freedom of Information Act request, and it was reported widely in the press at the time. The things that happen inside these detention centers, the stories that are lived there, are truly epic. And it's sort of, you know, that was one of the challenges in our film, was like trying to make the audience understand this was all, it really happened.
We should also point out Muhammad's story. He ends up in the United States like Marco does when he's only 3 years old. As you mentioned, his parents immigrated from Iran. And I think his story highlights an important part of the story, that this is not just a Latino issue. I mean, Broward, it seemed like, embodied the idea that we're talking about all kinds of different immigrant stories here.
Yeah, so the different detention centers around the country all have sort of different characteristics based on where they are geographically. And so the one in this particular detention center where our film is set is in South Florida. And so, you know, South Florida is kind of a nexus to the world, you know. So the people in detention are, you know, from the Caribbean, from South America. There's certainly some Mexicans there, but it's not necessarily the predominant population. There's Asians. There's a couple Europeans. It's really a kind of upside-down United Nations in that particular detention center. And another characteristic of this detention center, which is known as Broward Transitional Center, also called the Broward Detention Center in Broward County, Florida, is that it's low security. And so the immigrants there are, by definition, non-criminal. And so even Trump is saying, oh, we're focused on bad hombres and gang bangers. And this detention center exists for the good hombres. You know, it's a detention center, or if you want to think of it as like a kind of jail, it's a jail for people who haven't committed crimes. You know, we've become accustomed to Guantanamo in Cuba as this kind of no man's land legally, where people who haven't been charged are kind of detained for years and years. Well, one way to think about the immigration detention system is sort of like that. It's like these pieces of post-constitutional detention kind of all around the country. And Broward is sort of the tip of that iceberg because it's a detention center specifically for non-criminal immigrants. And so that was why the activists targeted it. They said, this is a place, if we get in there, we can make a lot of noise about this. Obama says he's not detaining and deporting people who haven't committed crimes. Well, why does this detention center for non-criminal immigrants even exist?
Yeah.
Let's try to shut it down. And that was the mission.
I want to play another moment from the film. It's how this group of young, smart activists basically move into action when they get a phone call. It's illustrated when Ismael, the young man we heard about earlier, he contacts the National Immigrant Youth Alliance. And in this case, we'll hear from Vidriana Martinez and Muhammad as they move into action once they get this phone call.
We basically did this whole intake when people called us. We got their name, their alien number, how they got detained, their history.
Ismael, what's his story, Vidi?
Ismael came by himself to the U.S. at the age of 12, and he's from Guatemala, and he has been here since, and he's 18 years old now.
Every deportation can be stopped. The government has the power to grant discretion for anybody not to be deported.
Yeah, so it's the National ICE in D.C. that can do something.
A perfect example is, you know, Obama's uncle, who's undocumented, he had a DUI. His deportation was stopped.
You know, once it was like, okay, this case is solid, we started an online petition.
Every time somebody would sign the petition, there was an automatic email that was generated that was sent to the personal email of someone that worked at immigration. We had probably 4,000 signatures in just the period of like 12 hours.
So the idea is to overwhelm, or I think as Muhammad puts it, annoy the hell out of these different congressional offices. And again, this goes back to something, Alex, you were talking about before. So this was how it worked before. I guess the question is now, it's the same kind of question. Does that same kind of pressure, does that same kind of activism, you know, annoying the hell out of these different congressional offices, overwhelming them, flooding them with petitions and signatures and phone calls, is it going to work in the same way?
We're about to find out. And Representative Ted Deutch, who's featured in the film, talking from the sort of congressman's point of view about what it's like to be the subject of this kind of a campaign. Yeah. He introduced what's called the private bill for Claudio Rojas, which is a piece of legislation introduced into Congress, basically naming a specific immigrant as somebody worthy of a status to be here in this country. So Representative Deutch did introduce that bill. So we're currently in a campaign to get other members of Congress to enter statements on the record in support of Claudio, to introduce copies of that same bill. So there's multiple versions of the bill. So the point is, like, it's hard to underline, but I have learned more about civics and navigating my own government from these undocumented activists who were fighting for their families. They've taught me how the government works, and we're in it right now, basically trying to get pieces of legislation through, trying to get political power exercised so that ICE decides to release this grandfather so he can go home with his family. The undocumented activists in our film decided, you know, we can't sit here for our lives being victims, being kicked around by the system. We have to figure out how it works. We can't vote. but we can certainly make a lot of phone calls and put up a lot of petitions. And so I think that's ultimately like the core of the story is it's a David and Goliath kind of story. It's a story about the most unlikely people in this country finding political power and sort of teaching the rest of us how it's done.
Yeah, it's a question that we all have, you know, whether these tactics are still going to work today, the tactics that we see in the film. But one of the things that I hope this film does is that when we think about this crisis that's been ongoing for a while, but we're just now seeing it as a crisis in the news, that when we think about solutions, that we turn to people who have the most experience. And in this case, we see that the people with the most experience are undocumented people themselves. Let's bring them to the table and try to solve this together. I hope that film makes that case for people.
Christina Ibarra, along with Alex Rivera, they wrote and directed the documentary film The Infiltrators, which you can see next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Alex Rivera will be joining us for a Q&A after the film. You can find details on our website, radiowest.org. They joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.